Mid-Michigan's home for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Its current state on WKAR. Glad you're aboard here for our Tuesday program. Legendary Detroit TV news anchor Bill Bonds died over the weekend. Bill Bonds led the WXYZ TV newscast from 1963 to 68 and again from 1971 to 1995. His funeral will be on Friday. In current state, Scott Pohl is here with a brief remembrance. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Mark. Bill Bonds was a larger-than-life figure, someone people came to watch, whether they liked him or not. He was confrontational, opinionated, and tough. He famously challenged Mayor Coleman Young to a boxing match once. Bonds even played a caricature of himself in Escape from the Planet of the Apes.
Bill Bonds reporting from Los Angeles, where the biggest story since the moon landing broke this morning when two apes talked, I repeat, talked to the Presidential Commission of Inquiry.
It's certainly the most incredible story this reporter has ever covered. I think that by their intelligence and their good humor, the two so-called aponauts have already captured the hearts of the entire American nation. They will not be required to appear before the commission tomorrow. That hearing, of course, is going to be held in private. They will, however, be taken from the zoo infirmary to a hotel, and they will be given an extended tour of the city. This is Bill Bonds, reporting for Eyewitness News. Good night.
Bill Bonds there, playing himself in the movie in the movie Escape from the Planet of the Apes. And Scott, many of us on the current state staff didn't know until yesterday that back in the day you rubbed shoulders with Bill Bonds. Tell us about that.
That's right. First of all, he and I both started at the same little radio station in Albion, Michigan.
No kidding.
WALM.
Oh my.
Now, I didn't know him in those days. He preceded me. But when I was a college student in the late 70s, I did an internship at Channel 7, and I worked on a story one day where I went out in the field and I happened to get bitten by a dog. And it happened to be the same day that WXYZ was welcoming their new station manager, Jean Findlater, who, as I recall, was the first woman to lead a top 10 market TV station in America. There was going to be this big reception on the news set after the early news. Well, it was about time for this reception, and I was in the men's room doctoring a bloody leg and bemoaning the state of my torn jeans and thinking that I wouldn't attend the reception because of the state I was in. When the men's room door opened up and Bill Bonds walked in, he somehow had heard that I had been bitten by a dog. Now, I believe this was probably the only conversation we ever had, and it was through the closed stall door. I never made eye contact with him, but he came in to check on me, and I told him I was thinking about not. I told him I was okay, and that I was thinking about not going to the reception because of my pants. They were bloody and torn, and he said, "No, of course you should go to the reception. You'll get more attention than anyone." And it turned out that he was right. I went to the reception, and I must have answered the question 100 times about what had happened to me that day. But it showed me that he cared about people.
And how about that? Okay, yeah. And none of us, you and I have rubbed shoulders for a bunch of years here now, and I didn't know about that account until yesterday.
That's right.
How about that? Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it a lot. Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. New contract bargaining between the United Auto Workers Union and American automakers is scheduled for next year. Recently, we've been getting a clearer picture of the union's priorities. Yesterday in Detroit, UAW President Dennis Williams said that wage increases will be an important part of the discussions. He has also indicated members want to eliminate a recently introduced feature of the auto worker landscape, two-tier wages and benefits. Back in 2007, the bottom was about to fall out of the U.S. automobile industry. Sales eventually plunged, and two of the Detroit Three would be bailed out of bankruptcy by the U.S. government. Part of that painful reckoning was the implementation of lower wages and fewer benefits for new hires at GM, Ford, and Chrysler. The car companies used the savings to invest in factories and to hire more workers. Instead of raises, the companies have occasionally paid out one-time bonuses and profit sharing. But today, workers, many of whom haven't got a raise in going on 10 years, say It's our time. To discuss that possibility and a few other related issues like the price of gasoline and others, Current State welcomes Sean McElinden. Dr. McElinden is the Executive Vice President of Research and Chief Economist at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor. Thank you for joining us.
Well, good morning.
UAW President Dennis Williams spoke with the media yesterday in Detroit, and he underscored the importance of raises and eliminating the wage gap. I want to quote from Dan Howe's column in today's Detroit News. Dan Howe's, not quote necessarily, I'll paraphrase. Dan Howe's writes that there will be a balancing act that's needed, and basically he says the Detroit Three have to acknowledge that 2007, 2008 are all in the past, the times are better, so why not offer raises? The union, on the other side, has vowed in the past to allow their employers to stay competitive on labor costs with their foreign rivals operating in the United States. Do you agree on this idea of this balancing act?
Yes, I do. On the other hand, it's time to admit the crisis is over, and it's time to, you know, try to find some sort of compromise that results in everybody at the same tier over time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and obviously an eye has to be kept on competitiveness. So, you know, I think both sides are listening to the people on the line and, you know, obviously want to make sure they stay happy, both the union and the companies.
A little bit of historical context here, though, at the first. Was the creation of the two-tier wage and benefit framework necessary for the survival of the U.S. automakers?
Yeah, I think it really was. And I think the Auto Task Force, in the spring of 2009, when they were considering the final details of the federal assistance, they were negotiated with the union in May of 2009 and made that two-tier wage, and especially the benefits part of it, a very big piece of the final negotiation settlement for the bankruptcy judge. It had an enormous influence. Many people at that time, including Treasury, thought that the labor agreement was a major factor in forcing GM and Chrysler into bankruptcy.
How much do wages and benefits differ between the two tiers of workers?
Well, essentially, not all workers at the second tier are at the top wage. They have a grow-in that takes them up to about $19.60 an hour. They start a little over $14. But essentially, if you include the benefits, it can range anywhere from $42 an hour. And, the first-tier workers are costing at this point about $65 an hour. Mm. So it's a $20, $22 an hour difference. The way the Canadian Auto Workers Union solved this competitive issue for new hires was through a very long grow-in period. 10 years, you start at $14.50 an hour and you grow all the way to that top wage year by year by year to $29, well, in their case, $35 an hour Canadian. But I think something like that's going to happen. It won't be 10 years, however. I think patience, there's not enough patience for that. It could be less. It could be less than 6 years. It could be, I'm sure the union wants it done in 3 or 4. And also, the first-tier workers haven't had a raise officially on their base rate, they call it. And most of them make $27 to $29 an hour on the line for the wage rate. They haven't had a raise since 2005. So we expect to see a raise 1-2% a year for about the length of the agreement per year. And, that grow-in, I think they'll convert to that, and hopefully it'll ratify, get enough votes to ratify the agreement at roughly 60%. That's really the objective here, is to get enough people to ratify the agreement so we can move on without any, hostility on the sidewalk.
But
you're
not suggesting, though, it seems to me you're suggesting that the car company's fortunes have not improved to the point where they could seriously entertain eliminating the two-tier framework, but maybe over a period of years?
Yes, I believe that. And it hopefully will not be a long period. I think they would argue, for example, this year, Toyota will earn three times to four times as much as Ford. And that's a lot of money for product development and competitiveness. And, the companies, aren't all the way back in terms of earning the money they need to maintain their competitive position. And there's also still legacy costs that remain outstanding for the health VEBA. You know, both Chrysler and Ford has paid theirs off. They no longer have that anchor around their neck. But the other two companies are still trying to eliminate this last vestige of legacy costs for the retirees. And they're paying out hundreds of millions per year still to fill that VEBA back up. So this would give them time to do that. They may even borrow the money this year at a fairly low rate to maybe finally pay that off. I hope they do. And then there'll be a lot of pointing at the transplants. Only basically Mercedes makes the same wage down in Alabama as the Detroit 3 pay at the first tier up here.
You mean by the transplants, correct?
Sure.
Okay.
Except the problem these days is that, this is a strange negotiation. You'll have three companies negotiating simultaneously for a pattern agreement, and they only have 45% of the market, and another 30% are these transplants in the South. But we find out in the South, the transplants are basically worried about competing with these new Mexican assembly plants, where the wages are much, much lower. And it could be very well, with GM's announcement, or the Mexican announcement this week, that GM's doubling its capacity in Mexico, that it's really the Mexican labor market that's still calling the tune on what's competitive. And that's very scary.
Sean McElinden is our guest. He is Executive Vice President of Research and Chief Economist at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor. We're talking about UAW contract bargaining sessions, which will begin in 2015, the possibility of wage increases and elimination of a wage gap between the two-tier workers at the Detroit 3. Michigan's recent right-to-work law also figures into this, since a disgruntled lower-tier union member is free to stop paying union dues. How will that figure into this?
That is figuring a bit into it. Obviously the right-to-work law was primarily aimed at the public sector and is probably having more of an impact on AFSCME, but if these second-tier workers, and that's almost about half the labor force now, 39,000 UAW at Chrysler and about 22%, at GM and Ford, if they remain disgruntled, if they don't think they've got, what they need out of this agreement, they'll figure, why should I pay dues? And we may actually see for the first time, because, there have been plants in right-to-work states elsewhere, UAW, that haven't lost members. But this time around, we may see some people asking to not pay dues. And, we just had a dues increase of 25% on the UAW. And so essentially, I'm paying an extra 25%. It's not just 2 hours a month anymore. What are you going to do for me? And we're doing the same work. Why is that guy making $29 an hour and I'm only making $19? And it doesn't make the guy at $29 an hour feel any better either. He doesn't like that. The motto of the union, as you know, is solidarity forever. This is right in its face. So, they could lose not a lot of members. They would be second tier, but Frankly, that's a concern for Mr. Williams, and he's admitted it. And the companies themselves don't want, we're trying to build quality, defect-free, high-quality, $32,000 cars and trucks on average, and we don't want an unhappy labor force in this auto industry.
The price of oil and gasoline has been a huge story, and economically is playing a role in putting some steam in the economy. At least that's the widely held conventional wisdom. How long before the price of oil triggers concern again because it's too high? Is that months away, years away? What do you think?
Well, I think it's years away. Demand overseas is falling. Other economies are not growing like ours. We can't even export most of our oil production to those other countries. Most of the fracked oil in the United States is on private sector land. We haven't even granted a new federal land permit in years. If that ever opened up under a new administration, there'd be even more oil pouring into the refineries, or stacking up. I think this is not a short-term phenomenon. It's got at least a two-year run. And, eventually the typical consumer looks at what's the price of gasoline going to be or diesel 2.5 years out or so when they make their decision to buy a car. But right now, based on what they saw in the last 10 years, I'm not sure they quite trust it yet. We are seeing, we'll see if they move from, let's say, small crossover vehicles like the CRV or the RAV4 to larger ones like the Chevy Traverse or the Buick Enclave. And if we start to see that happening, I want a larger vehicle because I think gasoline will stay closer to $2 a gallon. Then we're going to see a very significant shift in the market.
Mm. Let's touch on, you just alluded to a mm-hmm. vehicle manufactured here in Lansing. I'd like to ask you about Lansing's automotive footprint here. Mm-hmm. Less demand for Cadillacs lately has led to some layoffs at Lansing Grand River. Is mm-hmm. Cadillac still generally healthy in your view?
Well, they've invested $20 million in that luxury site, which, you know, Lincoln and Ford did not do. And they have unique cars, unique platforms. They're not selling well. They're making primarily sedans, which are not popular right now. The crossovers are. They need more of those in the Cadillac lineup. Obviously, workers are laid off. We think Delta Township's going to be hot. Workers can transfer there into the other kind of product. But Cadillac has to find another image to sell this new product. Yeah. And they also have big plans overseas, as you know, in like China. You know, it's sort of funny. Buick became a success story in China, one of the hottest nameplates in the country now for years. And now Buick's better in the United States. And I don't know if Cadillac can bring that kind of success story home. I hope so. But right now, yeah, it's a tough road to hoe for the CTS, ATS, you know, with their trunks, and they don't have a pop-up hatch. You know, which everybody seems to want on anything, even a BMW or a Mercedes. I mean, it's a very competitive market. And frankly, GM has gone the whole 20 yards on this. I mean, they really have poured a lot of money into it. And their CTS is a fantastic car. But just not doing that well.
Given all the macro factors, mm-hmm. Sean, the price of mm-hmm. oil and gas, the state of the larger economy, how do you assess the future of Lansing's GM operations? Will it continue to be a good thing to make crossover utility vehicles and Cadillacs and Camaros, I'll add?
Well, they're not the major long-run threat are some of these mandates from the federal government on incredibly high fuel economy levels. How do you get Cadillac to 60 miles per gallon, which passenger cars have to hit? The cross utilities can stay down around 40 miles per gallon, but will the public think that extra cost to get that is worth it? And, you know, that may shrink our market in the future with that higher cost, and at the same time, the gasoline is cheap. So I worry about that more. We expect the market to increase again next year and the year after that. After that, it's sort of a crapshoot, as always. We're a cyclical industry. But of all the industries in the United States running this economy, it's us and fracking that seems to be driving economic growth in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, thank goodness for that. I mean, and not to mention almost 99% of the job in employment gains we've seen in Michigan since 2009 have been driven by the auto industry.
Mm.
We would like more.
Dr. Sean McElinden is Executive Vice President of Research and Chief Economist at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor. Thanks for joining us, Sean.
Sure. Bye.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The water cycle is pretty simple. Evaporation, condensation, precipitation. But when urban areas filled with buildings and parking lots get in the way, the cycle gets interrupted. And that can cause all sorts of problems, from flooding basements to sewer overflows. A new project from the Great Lakes Commission is hoping to help solve those problems by reconnecting the natural watershed. And joining us to talk about the Greater Lakes Project is manager John Jackson. John, welcome to Current State.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us about the Greater Lakes Project here. What's it all about?
Well, our purpose here is to, as you well said in your intro, to get away from this artificial total dependence on pipes, which completely disrupts the natural flows and creates all sorts of problems for us in terms of flooding and very expensive infrastructure projects, which nobody can afford these days or never should have been able and needed to afford. And to get back to a more natural system where we're letting water flow through its natural cycle to infiltrate back into the ground where it naturally would have before, and to do a lot of reuse as well of water.
Give us one really relatable example of how we interrupt the water cycle.
Yeah. I think one of the things is, okay, the water, when it rains, the water falls on your roof of your house, and a lot of people have that it runs down, say, onto their driveway, and the driveway, the rain rushes off down the driveway onto the street and then down into the sewer system, into one of those what we call manholes, into the sewer system, and is dashed off to a nearby river or lake, often not that nearby. It may be miles away, and sometimes through a sewage treatment system. And that really creates problems because we have this huge flow of water that suddenly is running down the roads, creating floods, that dashes out through the pipe, the other end of the pipe, and causes erosion and flooding in the streams and the rivers where it goes out. And all it needs to do is, if we had let it naturally flow and infiltrate into the land where it would normally have fallen, it's so much easier to do.
John Jackson is our guest. John is the director of project or manager of the Greater Lakes Project. We're talking about interrupting the water cycle here today and the impact of that. How much of this project is going to focus on groundwater, John, and what role does groundwater play in the overall health of the Great Lakes watershed?
Well, it's funny because we tend to think of, the Great Lakes, and that's what we see, and we don't see the groundwater in the same way. But an awful lot of municipalities depend upon groundwater for their drinking water supply. Groundwater also discharges into the lakes and is part of the flow that is in the lakes, so water levels in the lakes are affected by it. And so groundwater is critically important. It's also what feeds the marshes, where all the birds and the wildlife that we so love to see and appreciate around, that's fed by groundwater. So it's critically important to us. And farmers, of course, really are very dependent on it as well.
The project also focuses on green infrastructure. So it's water conservation and green infrastructure. Let's focus just a bit longer on water conservation. What give us a good example of a water conservation tool?
Well, we all know the sort of standard things, you don't take the long shower, try to persuade your teenagers not to do that, good luck. But there's much more serious and dramatic things that we can be doing. For example, a lot of people have rain barrels where they catch the water off their roof and then use that to water their gardens. But we can take that a step further to cisterns, which is what a lot of our grandparents had, which was their main, a big holding tank in their basement usually, where the rainwater was collected into that and then used for household purposes. And so we can, through proper filtration of that, take that and use it to flush our toilets, for example. There's a municipality in the area where I live, I'm in Ontario actually, near Kitchener, and a municipality here, when they built their new municipal building, their main municipal building, they put in a big cistern to collect all the water that falls onto the roof. That's what they flush every toilet in that building with, is that rainwater. Mm. That's saving water. It's also saving money, because water is expensive to treat and so on, and so it costs us money as well.
I guess you just mentioned rain barrels. I guess that was the original green infrastructure, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was dramatic. The other sort of green infrastructure, and this is where we talk about dealing with stuff that's running off the roads, for example, is to have a impervious pavement. And there's a lot of areas now where people are Wisconsin has quite a bit of it, for example, where they've been doing a lot of experimenting with it. Because a lot of people said, oh, it won't work in a cold climate. Well, Wisconsin's a pretty cold climate, and they've been experimenting with it and finding that it is working.
Well, explain to our listeners, before we go any further, explain the meaning of the word pervious.
Okay, so the idea is, say you have a big parking lot at the shopping mall, and it's just hard surface, the water cannot soak through it, and so it rushes off into the sewer system. But instead, you can create the pavement so that the water will actually flow through it into the ground below. And that then is regenerating the water supply, which may be connected to a drinking water well that people are needing, or which will help the marshes and so on. And it doesn't have to flow off into this big sewer. And the other thing is, you'll see some parking lots now that are starting to be designed so they have what look like these really nice natural areas in them with trees and, you know, and nicely designed ditches that have great things growing in them. And a lot of people think, oh, that's just for the beauty effect. No, it's also for the effect that those become holding areas where the water can go and then gradually soak down into the ground below after the rainfall is over. So it's a very, you know, it makes the place look better, but also is so much better for our water supply and better for the environment.
Assuming there is an environmental payoff to these reforms, what about the dollar costs? Does that concern you? Are they particularly expensive to implement?
No, I mean, green infrastructure projects are low-tech. And low-tech is much cheaper than the huge infrastructure projects that we have of building huge pipes, of always having to expand the water treatment facilities. So anything that we can do to reduce the flow through the big pipes and through the big treatment plants will save us money, because it's so expensive to have to go in and rebuild those, to dig up the streets again, to replace the ones that are now falling apart because they're too old for us, to expand the sewage treatment plant. Those sorts of things are incredibly expensive projects. Green infrastructure can save us money because of taking us away to a lower-tech method from these high-tech expensive systems.
This is a topic we may well be more aware of here in the Lansing area, just because of the work of our longtime drain commissioner, Pat Lindemann, who's employed a number of these features here in projects throughout the area. So what you're saying is not falling on totally deaf ears. I guess that's really just all I'm trying to say. How big a difference can green infrastructure have on problems like flooding and stormwater discharge?
Well, the thing about that is, if you make sure that there's a big rainfall and it all runs off that road into the sewer, that's a huge amount of water. We're doing some work actually in Oakland County, in three municipalities there: Lyon Township, Commerce Township, and Southwest Oakland Township. And what we figured out there is that in terms of the amount of runoff from those roads, that in Lyon Township, for example, they have 96 miles of roads, and per year that means 130 million gallons of water flowing into pipes that could instead have flown into the natural environment outside of it and avoided that problem. So it's a huge amount of water that you can avoid. You know, for example, if you catch the rainwater from roofs, we've calculated that with the sort of rainfall that we have in southern Michigan, that in a very small community, say 1,200 households in it, that over 16 million gallons per year of water that would have to go through the sewer system can be avoided by simply having it caught in rain barrels or cisterns and put back into the natural system.
How did you become affiliated with the three townships in Oakland County?
Well, anybody that's a resident there is obviously affiliated with them. But if you check on the Great Lakes Commission's website, the glc.org, And if you go to the water resources heading, you'll find our project there. You'll find information about the work that's being done there, the sort of data that I've been showing to you. And it's an ongoing project where we're gathering more information and wanting to do more outreach.
I'm curious. I have to ask, do you know how County Executive L. Brooks Patterson feels about your work? He's a guy in the past who says he loves urban sprawl. That's what's made his county an economic powerhouse in Michigan. Do you know how Mr. Patterson feels?
I certainly know of him very well, and I haven't talked directly to him. I don't know if his staff have or not, but certainly some of his staff are enthusiastic supporters of this project. They're members of our advisory committee that is working on it. So they are directly involved. It's not just us going in as outsiders, but we are working with the municipal people in those municipalities.
Fascinating topic. We're glad you could join us. We've been talking about Greater Lakes, a project using green infrastructure and water conservation to help communities restore the natural watershed. John Jackson, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And this segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Coming up on Current State, our profile series continues with a chat with Lansing Symphony Orchestra music director and conductor Timothy Muffet. He has served in those roles in 2006 and has a few stories to tell. That and more after the break on Current State.
For keeping on top of the news.
You're listening to the BBC World Service.
I'm Robin Lustig.
I'm Julian Marshall.
This is Owen Bennett-Jones
with NewsHour.
For finding out what's happened.
They're out on the stage, the protest leaders, still trying to rally their supporters.
And for knowing why it's happened.
They've often then turned to the Taliban as another way of earning a living.
Stay in touch with the world with NewsHour from the BBC.
This afternoon at 4 on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's in-the-moment conversations that take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation. The talk is better when there's more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 3 on AM 870 WKAR.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore here on 90.5 WKAR. Timothy Muffet has served as music director and conductor of the Lansing Symphony since 2006. Muffet has filled those same roles with the Baton Rouge Symphony Orchestra since 1999. Tim was raised in Highland, Michigan. He's appeared with many prominent orchestras around the country as well, including the Symphony Orchestras of St. Louis, San Francisco, Houston, and the Grant Park Music Festival Orchestra in Chicago. Muffet's work's been marked by a blend of traditional and contemporary programming with a strong emphasis on community arts education. Timothy Muffet is the subject of today's Profile interview. Profiles is Current State's occasional series of extended conversations with notable mid-Michiganders. And WKAR's Peter Wharf speaks with Timothy about his life in music, which got started at the keyboard.
I began on piano because my parents, although not professional musicians, they had a strong musical background, and they knew that piano was sort of a fundamental instrument. And I don't think I'm sure they didn't start me on it because they wanted me to have a career as a musician. They probably, of course, didn't want me to have a career as a musician. But they knew that the arts were fundamental to developing the whole child. This is what it really comes down to. They knew that exposure to music was going to be good for any child. And so I'm appreciative that they had that. And then I'm also appreciative that I grew up in a school system that valued the arts. Again, not to develop professional musicians, but to develop the whole child. And we had exceptional general music and exceptional vocal music and exceptional instrumental music And there was a great deal of participation in it amongst the student body. And all of those people took that out into their lives and were much the richer for it. So I was very fortunate to be in a school district that really put a lot of value on the arts and have parents that saw the value too.
So you had that as a young person with your parents, with your school life, and you're involved in a lot of educational stuff with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra, too. So
sure.
It really kind of has come full circle, and it's payback time.
It is. And I would be remiss to not mention my sister, Diane, 10 years older than I am, who was probably the strongest musical force. She's a professional musician herself. She's was a public school music teacher in the Boston area for most of her career, and you know, was clearly my biggest influence in getting started in music.
What do you remember about your sister influencing your musical life as a kid?
Yeah, two things. She gave me my first record, my first LP.
What was it?
It was called The Baroque Trumpet. Haydn Trumpet Concerto on it, which is interesting because that's not a Baroque trumpet concerto, but it had, I can't remember the other. I still have it.
Yeah.
I mean,
you still have
it? I still
record.
Have it, yeah. I have all my vinyl.
Wow.
And then I remember her practicing, and I remember hearing her practice and making note of the discipline and making note of the work on etudes and the slow, methodical work. And again, you know, this, getting back into the educational component, even if I wouldn't have gone into music, if I would have gone into science, gone into law, gone into whatever, that learning that as a kid, learning the benefit of slow, methodical approach to anything,
yeah,
is, you take that with you the rest of your life. So it was really helpful for me to have that distance too, where, you know, she was, I don't mean this, she's going to hate me for saying this, but she was quite a bit older than I was. And, but to have that distance, but be able to watch that process in a sibling who was, you know, farther down the road than I was.
Right. So take that process, the slow, methodical process to approaching a score for the first time with orchestra. Do you apply that?
Oh, absolutely. It's score study is a very detailed process, and The one sentence version is, you look at the forest, then you look at the trees, and you look at every vein on every leaf of every tree, and then you step back and look at the forest for a long time. Right. And so I do have a very step-by-step process that I have evolved over the years. When one's in grad school, you're usually working on one or two pieces of music, and you're focusing on that, and then you perform those, you conduct them, and then you work on the next project. But you get out into the real world, and you may be preparing several concerts simultaneously. So I realized that the way I work, everybody's different in this area, but the way I work, I needed to have a systematic approach so that if I was working on concert A on Monday and then worked on concert B on Tuesday, when I came back to concert A on Wednesday, I knew where I had left off. I knew where I needed to go in the process. It's a process that is both musical and theoretical and analytical, and but fundamentally it's all coming down to the music.
Yeah. This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Timothy Muffett as part of our profile series here on Current State. Timothy Muffett, the music director of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra and also of the Baton Rouge Symphony. We'll be talking about his time with that orchestra as well. But first, Timothy, can we talk about that transition from being a young music student to a place where you thought, hey, maybe I can do this. Maybe I want to do this in my life. Do you remember when that was and what you thought?
Yes. Music is one of those things that I think once it grabs a person, it doesn't really let go. And I think that I saw myself having a career in music from very early on. Exactly when, I don't know, but I would say probably late middle school to early high school, where I realized that this was something I was good at, but it was also something that was really, really important to me, and that I was just drawn to very powerfully. Didn't mean I always wanted to practice, you know, like any kid or like any adult. But I knew that it was going to be important to me.
A lot of people say with something that's passionate, you didn't choose it, it chose you.
That's exactly the case. Right. Absolutely. And I'm really thrilled that it did. And I've been very fortunate in this career to have been able to make it my livelihood.
Talk about when you decided that conducting was going to be something that you would try out.
Right. That was in college.
Yeah.
I'd had an opportunity. I'd written an arrangement. I'll try to give you the short version of the story, but I had written an arrangement for a piece of music that was going to be recorded, and it was a string arrangement. And I was the one who knew the music, so I had to conduct the recording session. And it was very simple, but nonetheless, someone needed to do it. And after I did that, one of the cellists came up to me and said, I'm playing one of the Boccherini concertos on my recital in 2 months. Would you conduct that? And I said, oh, absolutely. And this was the beginning. And then soon I realized this was a very natural way of making music for me.
Your conducting career includes the Lansing Symphony, of course. You've performed with major orchestras, San Francisco Symphony, Houston Symphony. You've conducted at the Grant Park Music Festival in Chicago, and I'd like to ask you about those in a little while. But you've also focused your work in Baton Rouge, where you conduct now, and also before that with the Louisiana Philharmonic. Is there something about Louisiana that's special to you?
Well, I think there's something about Louisiana to anyone who's ever been there. I mean, Louisiana is a remarkable place, a place of remarkable culture and character and beauty. And I've been working down there for almost 20 years, have really enjoyed those affiliations. Yeah. I started right out of grad school. I was on the faculty at LSU for 4 years. And that was kind of where I really got my feet wet, no pun intended, in South Louisiana. And
they do call the football stadium the swamp there.
They do, yes. I think the foundation is the remarkable history of the area. And what that's translated to is a remarkable group of people that live there. And it really becomes about the people and the customs and the traditions and the culture, which... In many places in the United States, the culture has become kind of grayed. By that, I mean it's all blended, and you could be standing on any street corner anywhere, and it would look the same as any place else. And I feel that South Louisiana, especially, is one of those areas that's not like that, that there is no question where you are when you look around or you speak with the people. And I think it's a place that's really maintained strong character and is true to its roots and honors its long traditions.
Timothy Muffet is the music director of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra. He's talking with us today on Current State as part of our profile series of interviews. We've spoken about the Louisiana Philharmonic and the Baton Rouge Symphony, of course, that you conduct right now, along with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra. What are some of the performances that you can think of with the Lansing Symphony that really stand out to you from the last couple of years, where you really kind of look back or listen back in your mind's ear and think, yes, that was something I felt good about?
Right. Well, I think my audition concert was one I'll never forget. We did the Prokofiev Fifth Symphony, which was, that was my choice. And it was a bit of a, you know, that's kind of an unusual choice for an audition program, because usually someone will rely on the blockbusters, you know, the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony or whatever, which are also great pieces. But I don't know, when I sort of said, no, I'm just going to go for it and do the Prokofiev Fifth. That's a piece I really believe in. I think it's one of the great, great masterpieces of the 20th century. And it was just, that was a fantastic experience to work on that piece with the Lansing Symphony. More recently, you know, I look back at some of the new music that we've done. I think back to the Meslanka saxophone concerto that we did with Joe Luloff here, and that was a performance that came about just because of a combination of forces, including Joe and the composer David Meslanka, and the fact that I've got these two orchestras that I conducted. David originally wrote that piece for wind ensemble, and I got him on the phone and I said, you know, the world needs a saxophone concerto for orchestra. It's such a remarkable instrument. Would you consider orchestrating this piece? I said, if you will, I can guarantee you two performances in two different orchestras with two extraordinary musicians, the other one being Griffin Campbell in Baton Rouge. And so I see that as a synergy of this relationship that made the music world a better place, you know, and really think back positively on that. All of the works we've done with the choruses that David Rail assembles have been memorable, because he just does a really terrific work there. But I'll tell you, the Mendelssohn Fourth Symphony we just did a few weeks ago, it was a thrill to be on the stage with the orchestra. They played that so very beautifully.
What do you like to listen to when it's not classical music?
Well, classical music is my primary leisure time listening, but anything that's good. I mean, it was Duke Ellington said it best. He said there are two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. And I certainly love Ellington and love a lot of jazz, but anything that's played well and with conviction and from the heart, all kinds of music.
Timothy Muffett is the music director of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra. He's part of our profile series here on Current State on WKAR. Timothy, we'll have you back again soon, but until then, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, Michigan's lame duck legislature is still flapping over a road funding solution. The Citizens Research Council of Michigan's been crunching the numbers on the two competing proposals. We'll check in with the CRC's Bob Schneider. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Also today, Current State says goodbye, or at least so long, to an original team member today. Since the launch of our program almost 2 years ago, Aaron Young has gone above and beyond the call of duty so many times. We can't keep them all straight. We can't count them all. We've been in the best possible hands with Aaron as our studio engineer. AY, you will be missed. Many, many thanks for all of your strong, conscientious work. Hope you can join us tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.